two questions. My first question is, as Gene knows, and Dr. Haff knows, I'm in Baltimore City, and I have a very large Medicare patient population with chronic diseases, which are high-risk patients. Unfortunately, most of our patients in Baltimore City do not have access to internet at home, smartphones, tablets, etc. They do have telephones. Are we going to expand in the state of Maryland telemedicine and include telephonic conversations for that, so we are able to keep our practices open and build these patients and try to avoid them from coming into the office for exposure?
Thank you for the question. And at least a simple answer, but it's not going to be a complete answer, is that Medicare does currently, as of this year, pay for telephonic consultations. So it's a way to at least mitigate that financial impact and be able to communicate with patients that way and within the Medicare guidelines. Medicaid and commercial payers do not compensate for that, to my knowledge. So that's a bit of an answer, but whatever health the department can give you and whatever assistance we can give you in terms of the guidelines and care for those patients or potentially accessing, for those that do have tablets or smartphones to access telemedicine, we're more than happy to help. And I know you serve a very challenging population, as most of our providers do, and I think it's going to be a challenge for all of us over the next several weeks and maybe longer in dealing with this. Please be assured that MedCAI and the Maryland Department of Health and the governor and all of the state agencies are going to do everything we can do to support you. There will be things that we can't do just simply because of supplies or other things, but anything I'm sure that the governor could do to mitigate this, he will be more than willing to do.
Perhaps, Dr. Haft, at the MDPCP level, we can initiate a temporary measure where telephonic communication to our patients can be reimbursed somehow.
Yeah, as I said, it can be for Medicare now. So that is already allowable.
And maybe we can put those posts up as well on the website.
We absolutely will. We'll be posting those.
My second question is that there are a lot of physicians, primary care physicians over the age of 70 that continue to practice. In my group, I have a partner who's over the age of 70. I know they're considered higher risk, but if they're generally healthy with no cardiopulmonary disease, they're not immunocompromised, what would your recommendation be to them if they're continuing to see patients in their office?
So I don't have any CDC or Department of Health guidance on that. I think with the general guidance is, for individuals who are over 60 to do social distancing, the guidance becomes much more significant in terms of the more at risk an individual is. So someone you described who is 70 and healthy and probably is much lower risk than somebody who would be 65 with multiple chronic conditions or end-stage renal disease. So I think that's a case-by-case decision. There's no prohibition for that provider from seeing patients. But the cautious thing to do would be to have them absolutely be doing the good hand washing. And if there are patients who are coughing, they should have masks when they're in contact with them and those sorts of things. So thank those 70-year-old physicians for their long and loyal service at the same time.
Perfect. Thank you very much.
And we'll take our next question.
Try it again. Tom? Hi. Can you hear me?
Yes, sir.
Yes. Hi, Howard. This is Bob Miller. How are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm good. I got a question. I'm glad to hear that in children we don't need to test them. You know, I'm a pediatrician, of course, in Southern Maryland. And number one, what age is considered not to test? And two, how do we go about telling the pediatricians in the state of Maryland and the citizens in the state of Maryland that the children don't need to be tested, number one, so they're not alarmed, and two, so that they don't line up at the centers in their cars and know that they don't need testing so they don't go there.
And staff.
So thank you for the question. I don't think that I indicated that children don't need to be tested. I think if there's a child who has a chronic illness or immunocompromised and has compatible symptoms, they certainly may, based on your clinical judgment, want to be tested.
No, I'm talking about healthy children.
What I understand, so what I understand from our pediatricians is that children who have coughs and colds in general would not yield a high result, and since they are not a great risk, you know, they have not been recommending doing COVID-19 tests on children who have low-grade fevers, coughs, and colds, since it's such a high prevalence and such a low risk. That's the only guidance that I've been given, and I think we're still in the process of defining what the specific guidance is. There's no CDC guidance specific to pediatrics, and the state doesn't have has not posted any specific guidance. So this is in general. Your clinical judgment is where the guidance would come from.
But for healthy children who have colds and coughs, which is the most of what we see, most of the patients, the most prevalent illness, and they call on the phone and they have a runny nose, maybe sore throat, they have a fever, they come in, they could have the flu, they could have many illnesses. These children come in, they could have coronavirus. But I got the impression from you that those are not the children. They don't need to be tested unless they've been exposed to somebody or there's some mitigating issue related to the illness. Otherwise, they don't need to be tested. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's generally correct.
Okay. So I think it should be known in the state of Maryland, because I think parents don't know that. And the physicians don't know that. So, because otherwise, all of the children could be tested. They're going to go to St. Mary's Hospital where they have a facility. They're all going to be wanting to be tested. I think there needs to be some notification from the state of Maryland as to which children should be tested and why, that they are immunocompromised, they have sickle cell disease, or they have leukemia, or they have some reason. Obviously, those children also have specialists. But I think that's important for the offices, the staff, and the children, so that we don't waste resources and parents are aware that they don't necessarily need to be tested.
I would say the answer to your question, again, is that in general, based on your clinical judgment, which is what I'm interpreting the clinical judgment to be in this situation, that they don't need to be tested. So the guidelines are not specific, again, to pediatrics. The guidelines say that if an individual has the symptoms, that is a fever, cough, and respiratory distress, then they would be someone who would be susceptible to testing, but it's based on your clinical judgment and the epidemiology in the context that you're in. So your clinical judgment would be the thing that supervenes here. And I would say your clinical judgment says these are children who always get coughs and colds at this time of the year. I don't think that this warrants a test.
Okay.
that's the best, that's what the current guidance is. So it really goes back to your clinical judgment. I don't think that we'll say children don't need to be tested. That is not at all what I'm saying, and I don't think you'll find any guidance like that anywhere. It really is up to us as individual clinicians to make those decisions. In some cases, we don't really want to have someone say they shouldn't be or they should be tested. That's too far away.
Well, what happens when it's not necessary physicians to order the test and the parents can get the test on their own?
So I don't anticipate that there'll come a time that parents will be able to get tests on their own. Right now, the only test currently, although again that may change shortly, tests can only be ordered by providers. It may be that for individuals who don't have a provider, that in the near future local health departments may be able to also order tests, but they're not going to be, I don't anticipate self-ordered tests anytime in the near future.
Okay. So we could say that if a child comes in with a routine illness, as a summary, runny nose, congestion, fever, it would be up to the individual doctor to determine whether the test is done. And for the most part, in pediatrics, since it's a mild illness, coronavirus, that testing, if the physician says no testing, then that's acceptable, correct?
That's correct, because the guidance is your clinical, is guided by your clinical judgment.
Okay.
Thank you. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you.
And we'll take our next question. Caller, your line is open. Please go ahead.
Hi, my question was answered already. It was about the sensitivity and the specificity of the testing that's being done. Thank you.
Thank you. Moving on to our next question.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Hello? Okay, hi.
Yes.
This is Michelle Lavender. I'm a dermatologist. And I was wondering, for those of us in specialties like mine, in which a majority of patient visits are for non-urgent, non-acute issues, what are the recommendations regarding continuing to see patients in our clinic? Should we be broadly canceling our clinics, seeing only urgent matters, trying to keep people at home, or should we just be screening out for patients who have symptoms of corona and keeping those patients out of the office? Our practice has had some trouble making decisions on this.
Yeah. No, thank you. It's a great question. And really, that's a very good question. I think other than encouraging staff to do good hygiene, surface cleaning and those kinds of things that I'm sure you're doing already, and then putting a mask on anyone who's coughing, and perhaps redirecting them to their primary care provider or not, you should be going about your business. I think As usual, I don't think we have any desire or anyone wants to interrupt the usual provision of care at dermatology or any other specialty practice. Other than the general guidelines, I think you should be just advising your staff to continue doing business and don't shut down. I think that would be probably sending a wrong message. Where that may change in time is, for certain, elective surgical procedures. If it turns out that hospitals become more significantly burdened, particularly ICUs, if they become burdened, as we've seen in other countries, ventilators become scarce, we may make suggestions about elective procedures, but that would not I think apply at all to your dermatology practice. So I hope that's helpful.
Yes, thank you very much.
And if you find that your question has been answered, you may remove yourself from the queue by pressing *2. Moving on to our next question.
This is actually perfect timing for my question. This is Heidi Abdelhaden from Baltimore. I'm an ICU physician. So a couple of questions. One is, are you recommending negative pressure or HIPAA filter rooms versus just PPE with droplet precaution? Two, is there a state-coordinated effort to centralize care for those confirmed to have COVID-19 disease that require hospitalization? And I'm specifically thinking about the hospitals that have biocontainment units. And finally, do we have criterion in Maryland on resource allocation? Should we get to a point where we are practicing almost catastrophic medicine, where we experience a surge in demand for vents and ICU beds that exceeds our supply? Thank you so much.
Thank you for the questions. The guidance regarding providing care within ambulatory settings currently is the rooming for those patients who are being evaluated for testing should be a closed door and well-ventilated room. It does not demand HIPAA filters at this time, but it does require appropriate donning, doffing of PPE, disposal of the PPE, and surface cleaning in a typical ways. To regard to centralization of care for individuals, I don't believe that is currently being considered. I think all ICU beds are monitored on a daily basis. The availability both of ICU beds and of ventilators is monitored by the state since the beginning of this outbreak on a daily basis, and surge capacity is being looked at in an aggressive way. So I can't give you a specific detail on what that is, what the interventions are for surge capacity, because it's a separate group that's working on that from my group. But I know they're working diligently on the surge capacity issue, and the surge capacity issue could potentially look at other facilities besides our 47 acute care hospitals. And in terms of the biocontainment unit, they certainly are available for treatment, but in most cases, an isolation room for individuals who require ventilator support has been adequate. And I can't say what's going to happen in Maryland, but I know in other countries they have used non-invasive ventilation, and those have been done on even less restrictive floors when the circumstance is such that there's widespread disease and scarce capacity. So then both invasive ventilation and non-invasive ventilation. But this is, again, something that we'll be developing over time, and I encourage you to look at the Department of Health website and probably the information you can get from from the hospitals that you work in that can give you what their circumstances are and what their anticipated responses will be. I hope that's helpful.
If I may, just with regard to non-invasive ventilation, high-flow nasal cannula, and actually nebulization of bronchodilators, in a lot of our society publications, again, we realize this is a novel virus, but the recommendations have been to steer away from further potentiating aerosolizing the virus and really going to an earlier intubation if the patient is heading down the respiratory failure, high oxygen and pressure need health status.
So, and I defer to you on that. I am not a critical care intensivist, so I certainly thank you for that. And I've given you, only in terms of the broadest terms what we've seen, in terms of broad-based interventions from other countries, and completely defer to you on other technical aspects of that.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And once again, that is star one if you would like to ask a question. Moving on to our next question. Caller, your line is open. Please go ahead.
Yes. I was just asking because I had a patient. My name is Dr. Abuna. I had a patient ask that she traveled out of the country, like an elderly patient, to five different countries into five different planes. And now she wants to know if she should self-quarantine, and I didn't have an answer for her.
So it would depend a little bit on the thank you for the question. It would depend a little bit on what countries, but I would suspect if she had recent travel to five different countries and five different airplanes, it would be prudent for that individual to self-quarantine.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. You're welcome.
We'll take our next question. Moving on to our next caller. Caller, your line is open. Please go ahead. Hearing no response, we'll move on to our next caller. But as a reminder, if you find that your question has been answered, you can remove yourself from the queue by pressing star 2.
Hi, this is Lynn Nowry in Baltimore. I have one comment and two questions. First, on a physicians group I'm on, I noticed somebody posted an article from 2006 in which doctors were able to convert one ventilator to vent four people. It's by Naiman and colleagues in the Academy of Emergency Medicine. Not sure if that's useful, but just in case. I have a lot of immunocompromised patients, so I know that they're at risk of more severe disease. I wanted to know if there's any known difference in the time to decline. And the second question is that the French health minister, I guess, has recommended not using NSAIDs, particularly ibuprofen. Is that true for us too? And what about aspirin, especially in cardiac patients?
So I was aware of the multiple patients on the single ventilator. I think that's, a hospital innovation that, I would hope we don't need to come to, but I know that it would be an innovation. And sadly, I can't really tell you any credible evidence on NSAIDs or aspirin. To my knowledge, and based on most current, at least national guidelines, there's no prohibition to using any of the current therapies in the context of coronavirus disease. That does not mean that evidence wouldn't emerge, but I can't validate any anecdotal evidence by another country's health minister. It may or may not be true. I wish I could give you better guidance on that, but I can't.
And any difference in time to decline among immunocompromised patients?
I think this is again in the technical area. I have not seen anything on that. Anything written in the literature that I see on this, it could very well be that that there are different rates of decline and other complications that occur in immunocompromised patients, but none that I have seen. I would ask if you get that information from your research and literature, please pass it on to me because I would be very interested in that also.
Yeah, sure, Bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And we'll take our next question.
Hi, this is Dr. Nancy Anthracite. I have a question about the personal protective equipment. to me, if we had adequate amount of it, the staff should be wearing masks when they meet patients and many other things that I think that would be helpful, but we don't have. I'm wondering, it seems reasonable to me that there may be a way to quickly create more personal protective equipment by investigating something like stitching together paper towels or, you know, Brawny brand or something like that that could be done fairly rapidly by potentially volunteers if somebody were to investigate the adequacy of that. And I would think that, you know, universities could do that. So I want to throw that out and ask if you know if anything like that is being explored.
I think that's a very innovative idea. I'm not aware of that being done anyplace. And I would, but again, in terms of one comment that you made, I would say that staff do not need to wear masks. The masks are for, unless they're obtaining samples from patients.
I'm aware that that's what's being said, but I don't think it's logical to say that if you had plenty of personal protective equipment around, that the staff shouldn't be putting it on both to protect themselves and protect the patient. I think this is a matter of there's not enough PPE, so this is what's being said, my personal opinion.
Okay. And I thank you for that. And what you said is absolutely true, that's an opinion that you have, and I wouldn't want to dissuade you. I merely want to say that the guidelines say that the mask should preferentially be used for the patients, particularly anyone who's coughing. Infinite supply of masks, it perhaps could be a different guidance, but if there's not.
Right, I understand.
Thank you.
Is there any way to suggest that my suggestion be investigated?
I will be happy to suggest that, and I think you should also suggest that to university colleagues. The department doesn't do that kind of research, but universities and perhaps others would. And I think that one of the things that we are great at it here in the United States is that innovation, and that certainly sounds like an innovative idea. I can't validate, which brand of.
I expect that some brands are better than others, but I don't know. But I don't think that it'd probably be that hard to investigate because it's probably standard.
Right,
So it can probably
not work the Department of Health will be doing, but we'll look eagerly to see if someone comes up with a good solution, because we could all use a better solution for PPE. Thank you for your question.
Thank you.
And once again, that is star one if you would like to ask a question. We'll take our next caller. Caller, please go ahead. Your line is open.
My question was answered. Sorry, I couldn't remove it.
That's okay. Thank you so much. Moving on to our next question.
Hi, this is Ritu Prasad. My question is around patients who we do have a suspicion that fits the symptoms, perhaps have a comorbid condition or older in age, who don't need to go to the ER. Is there a list of resources as to where we can send them for testing?
Yes, they're great question. And they can be tested in office if you have the appropriate testing facility in terms of equipment and PPE. Currently, there are a few what we call drive-through testing facilities. There will be more of those in the days and week to come. And those will be the additional resources for testing. So the three opportunities to rehash that are either testing in your office if it can be done safely and appropriately, testing at the emergency department or hospital when necessary, and then third, progressively more some drive-through facilities for doing testing based on providers' orders.
Do those already exist, or that's forthcoming?
I understand that there was one that was stood up over the weekend, and additional sites that will begin on Monday, and then more that will be developed during the week. And we'll be posting on the Department of Health website, I anticipate beginning Monday, the locations, the time of operation, and any other the logistical information about those sites.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
And we'll take our next question.
Hello. I have a question and want some clarification about the telemedicine. Medicare expanded the use of telemedicine in light of the coronavirus, and the Maryland Department of Health stated at this time, we ask that you make every attempt to provide remote care for patients through telemedicine or telephonic communications. So does this mean that we can use telemedicine for every patient or only for corona-vulnerable patients?
It's for any patient that you want to use telemedicine for that would be applicable. So patients who are, for instance, who don't have coronavirus but perhaps are significantly elderly and have chronic disease and you don't want to have them come into your office at a time when the office visit itself may represent a relatively increased risk of contracting the virus because of the time in transit, because of potentially time in waiting rooms, and for other reasons, those patients also would be appropriate for telemedicine. It's not intended to do telemedicine for things that are not appropriate for telemedicine, but the expansion is for any patient, not just people who have coronavirus disease. I hope that's helpful.
And Dr. Happ, I'm gonna go ahead and expand on that answer and let you catch your breath for a second. Dr. Happ and the health department are about to release a kind of summary of the different coding and how it works for telemedicine, and we'll push that out to MedChi members. And again, I just want to reiterate, because we've probably had about 7 questions related to telemedicine tonight, if anyone has an issue with regards to telemedicine, please reach out to us. We have a team at MedChi underneath of Colleen George of folks who can help you either use CRISP more effectively with the HIE, or we can help you take advantage of the Dr. First offer, or we can help you with another telemedicine opportunity. This is a great way to keep patients from coming into a situation where they can be infected, and now that you can get paid to do it, it can really prevent the spread of the disease. So we want to be a resource to help doctors implement this. There are tools that can get up and running in a matter of hours. So please reach out to MedChi. You can use any email address you have for us and let us know, and we'll follow up and try to help you with that. Go ahead, Dr. Haft.
Thanks.
That's a good answer, and thank you for the question.
And once again, that is *1 if you would like to ask a question. We'll take our next caller.
Yes, hi. This is Dr. Saba. I'm a pediatrician in Montgomery County. I want to thank Jean and Dr. Daft for doing all this. I'm trying to think a little bit ahead here. I recently, just last week, in order to get the surgical masks, ended up only getting about 20 and having to pay a good deal for the shipping, as much as what the masks were costing, which is fine. But my concern is when the surge hit and we're on the forefront, is are we looking at what the state can do to actually deliver and get what we need on our primary care front to care for the patients of this state? This is my concern. It's fine, I appreciate all the guidelines, but the reality is we don't have the equipment to do what is being asked to be done. I drove by the CVS, the drive-in, to get medication, And the person who's filling, I mean, the guy didn't even have gloves himself. They couldn't get it. So, I mean, this is concerning to me as a physician in the state. This is what we're facing. I know you may not have the answer, but I think these are things that we need to look at. That's kind of my comment there. The question I have, which I'm trying to understand, you made a statement that this virus is 10 times more lethal than the flu. And I'm trying to understand, is that particularly in the 80-year-olds, is that based on comparison studies of if the flu hits someone who's greater than 80, it does X, Y, and Z, and this does it in X moments of hours? I'm trying to understand where that assessment is coming from. So thank you.
Sure. Thank you. So I sincerely appreciate your comment on the lack of availability of personal protective equipment. And it's something, again, that's the highest priority for the state. It is a national crisis in terms of personal protective equipment. And I think we're doing everything we can do, as others are also, to find more of a very scarce resource. Some of it will be in the clearly in the development of new pipelines to produce that equipment, because the shelves are truly bare. The second to your comment on your question regarding remind me again what your second question was.
It was about that this flu virus, that this coronavirus is actually 10 times.
I'm sorry. Yes.
Right. No worries. You've had a lot to answer tonight.
No. So let me say this is a simple answer. This was quoted. It's a quote from the National Institute of Health, from the director who made that statement nationally on national television, and I don't have a source for where he got that information from, but Anthony Fauci is as credible a source of information as anyone is, and it was his determination in terms of lethality.
So, if you don't mind, if I can take a moment to follow up on this, as a practitioner, I think I'm feeling a little, actually quite sort of frustrated in the sense that, you know, we're trying to stem off the pandemic here, trying to follow guidelines, you know, given the fact that we don't have everything to be able to test. But as a pediatrician, we know that a vector are these kids. We can't truly, on a clinical basis, because of the way they present, say if it's COVID-19 or not. So let's just be real factual about this. I love my clinical acumen. I've been practicing for 20 years, but facing what we're facing right now, kids are kids, and their runny nose could be COVID-19, could be other coronavirus, could be RSV. If we're really trying to contain things, I really would urge to have better guidance as to where we need to go if we're going to protect our population.
Yeah, you know, thank you. I think it's certainly something that we everyone wants to do in this circumstance. And the action that was taken in terms of reducing the spread in the pediatric population was closing the schools for 2 weeks. And that may not be the only action that was done, but that was in terms of public health mitigation intervention. That was the expert panel that serves the governor was their advice is what's the best thing we could do right now to stop the spread. That was it.
I understand that, but I don't think we should fool ourselves to keep saying we should only do something if we have a known positive test. We're not testing. We're not going to have a known positive test.
Yeah. No. Absolutely. So that, and I don't think we haven't said that at all. And just to clarify, we've said that the individuals should be engaging in social isolation. They should be going to large groups. They should be doing hand washing. They should bring in supplies and medications in case they need to do those things. If they suspect that they, without a test, if they are someone who is at who has signs and symptoms of coronavirus disease that they should self-isolate at home. And your question mm-hmm. is, should we self-isolate all the children at home? And I say, that's your clinical judgment. It's case by case. If you think right. that should happen, it should happen. It may be excessive in some cases. It may not be excessive.
Mm-hmm.
I think we're doing many things, but we shouldn't do everything based simply on a test. Because if we do that and we wait for the availability of 6 million tests for Maryland, many things will have happened while we're waiting for those tests to become available. So again, the pipeline, the best evidence is that the pipeline for testing will now make it more broadly open by having drive-through places where people can get tested, knowing that we're limited in terms of office supplies to be able to do that in terms of PPE, but we'll also mm-hmm. be limited in terms of other technical things along the way that will not allow us to test everybody. And in a pandemic like this, if you wanted to be complete, you probably to understand everyone who has the virus, you'd probably have to test everyone. It's just not possible. So I think we're doing what we're describing is doing the best we can given the circumstances right. and the supplies that we have.
Thank you very, very much for everything you are doing. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Moving on to our next question.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Hi, my question is regarding University of Maryland just canceling the program, which was the semester abroad. And a lot of these teenagers are coming back to Maryland from Spain, Italy, Argentina, and other countries. When they come in, what do we recommend them? Like, what is the social isolation for them? And what about their families, like their parents, brothers, sisters? What should they be doing? Thank you.
So they should self-isolate for 14 days. Checking their temperatures, and their family members should be socially distancing from them.
So the family members
also should cut.
The family members, do they also not go to work or go to
the family members. That most of the scenarios, if I would assume if they're self-isolated, they stay healthy, they're in contact potentially with their provider, they may or may not need a test. If they had a test and the test was positive, and the family members were in close contact with those individuals, then they would self-isolate also. For someone who's coming back and is being prudent from coming back from Italy where there's a widespread disease, the prudent thing would be to self-isolate and keep a distance, do social distancing from family. If they don't have any symptoms, there wouldn't be any reason for getting a test. Probably if they were otherwise young and healthy and had mild disease, there still might not be a reason for getting a test, and family should just do social distancing.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you for the question.
And we'll take our next question.
Yes, my name is Dr. Yu, and I'm from Westminster, Maryland. My question is, if you work in a long-term care facility, such as inpatient psychiatric hospital, and one of the patients become positive, how do you quarantine them? And also, what are the steps if they have symptoms? Do you just tell them not to come to work, or who should be tested and who should not be tested? Because there is a lot of staff members too who take care of the psychiatric patients.
So thank you for the question. In terms of congregate care, and particularly with the with things within the Behavioral Health Administration, for the state. They have their, they've posted their own FAQs, Fed frequently asked questions and answers, and I would refer you to those for within the Behavioral Health Administration, because they have some unique circumstances. Outside of that, any patient that that tests positive should be isolated. And again, if they are within a state facility, I would again direct you to specifically to the policies and procedures there, because they are unique, and I don't want to provide you with information that would be inaccurate regarding those patients. If you have contact with a patient who is known to be positive, and it is with its close contact and prolonged contact, then you should self-isolate and notify your provider. I hope that's helpful. And thank you for the question.
What about the steps? Because, you know, sometimes they might have symptoms too. Should they be tested too, or only if they become, you know, have contact with the patient? Because they could have the virus too.
Yeah, right. The contact is close contact over a prolonged period of time to a known positive patient that would trigger someone self-isolating. So if it's casual contact, coming by briefly or not for a prolonged period of time, or not close contact, the current guidance there's no necessity to self-isolate. Of course, if any person who develops signs and symptoms should contact their provider and then consider either self-isolation and or testing.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
And we'll take our next question. Caller, your line is open. Please go ahead.
Yes, Dr. Zugu from Baltimore. Thank you for a very informative meeting. My question is regarding wearing masks. I know this has been asked before. Some of the staff are uncomfortable today just to see patients without even having the mask themselves. Or some of them feel that they have to put on a gown so that by the time, end of the day, they'll just take the gown off and don't take any contaminant home. What is wrong with allowing them to do that if we can have those materials?
So thank you for the question. They're not encouraged to do that. It's not within the guidelines. I think if that's something that you want to have your staff do, you're not prohibited. I would only put it in context of we know that those materials are in scarce supply. And being in scarce supply, we may need them more at a later date. Past that, I would say that you're not prohibited from doing those things, but our best guidance is that it's not necessary at this time, and it would be best to save those for the circumstances where they will prove to be most effective. But it's not prohibited, and I fully understand how staff will be concerned, as we all are, about the condition and the contagion, and the staff are in the front lines. Past that, I would say that you're as a provider and a leader, staff will often look to you for your level of guidance and comfort, and they will follow that. So I would say do the best you can with your staff and encourage them to look at the guidelines that are written and see if that provides them some comfort also. Thank you for the question.
Sure, thank you very much.
And we'll take our next question.
Hello?
Hi. Yes, sir.
This is Amit Bhargav. I have two questions. One you may have already covered. How long does the virus stay on a surface? How long is it viable?
So we don't know for certain. Again, there's a, this, and I hate to keep saying we don't know for certain, but there's a lot of things that we don't know about this condition. I've seen written that up to 24 hours that the virus can be viable on a surface. I don't have confirmation for that. That's it was in a casual non-scientific publication, non-refereed publication.
Second was, I mean, everybody has spoken about masks and protective equipment. Ours is a small office, and our supplier says we are not eligible to receive masks and protective equipment because we have never ordered them before, so they're allotted based on that. I think the Gene may be able to help in this, but our suppliers are not giving us any protective equipment.
Yeah. Well, and I hear what you're saying loud and clear, and I think that's been the extant issue, that there have been very scarce supply. And again, the state is making every effort to source additional PPE from wherever it can be sourced, you know, from federal or private enterprise. So as soon as it's available, we will make that known and distribute it as needed around the state.
Okay. Thank you very much for a very informative session. Thank you.
Thank you for being patient and staying on this long.
Thank you, sir. Moving on to our next question.
Thanks for a wonderful, this is George Bowen. Thanks for a wonderful presentation. All surfaces were covered, and in answer to the question how long it could last, just reviewed a preprint publication stating it could last for up to 3 days.
Thank you, Dr. Bone. Appreciate that.
Yeah.
And moving on to our next question.
Oh, hello?
Yes.
Go
ahead.
So my question is, this is Dr. Faith Hackett, and it goes back to having PPE protection. I'm a pediatrician, and we are trying to figure out how to separate whether or not our well babies, because we have a lot of checkups, and whether we should be postponing them. Right now we're not, according to the guidelines. But can anybody help us with this? Because you
so
can't
thank you for the question.
Right.
Yeah, thank you for the question. I think there's not been any guidance that says that you should stop seeing either well babies or others. I think it would be up to your office if you wanted to separate out sick from well. I know some pediatric practices do that anyway, but it's again, it's not within the guidance to do that. I think that, you know, there may be a challenge with putting masks. There certainly would be a challenge with putting masks on all children who come in with a cough. And the only comfort I can give you there is, again, that the except for children who have otherwise underlying conditions, this seems to be a fairly innocuous condition for children. We don't understand why, but it is a fairly innocuous condition for children. So I hope that gives you at least some comfort that, you know, you probably are going to be in a relatively safe harbor in terms of the children that you serve. At least that's been
right,
the global experience so far.
I am happy with that. I do know that. I think the bigger dilemma is what I think a few earlier people have referred to with having subclinical cases that come in, and we're separating well babies from sick babies. We're being very careful about that, but we can have potentially in the future, not currently, of course, but in the future, well babies that may be subclinically possibly passing on the pandemic. So again, maybe this is a little bit of my anxiety just speaking out loud, and we'll just have to follow it.
No, I think we're all anxious, and I think in pediatrics it has the particular nuances with the fact that we certainly have said that the symptoms of corona disease are also the symptoms that many children get for things that are not corona disease related, and it makes it hard to separate out. And it's fortunate that children don't seem to be severely affected by this condition, or it would be a much more significant kind of issue to deal with. But I think we're all under some degree of anxiety now, appropriately, about what we can do as healthcare providers in this very unique circumstance. And thank everyone who's been on the line asking really excellent questions. It shows the level of interest and dedication that you all have for doing the best job for the people, adults and children that you serve. So thank you for the question, and no apologies. Don't need to apologize for anxiety at all.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you.
And once again, that is star one if you would like to ask a question. Moving on to our next caller.
Hi, this is Renee Bovell calling. And again, like others have mentioned, I appreciate Dr. Haft and Ned Kai for this call, very informative. My question is regarding surgery. I'm an ophthalmologist, and similar to the dermatologist, we do a lot of non-emergent routine cataract surgeries, glaucoma surgeries. Currently, I operate at a surgery center. It's a hospital-affiliated surgery center. Many colleagues operate at private surgery centers. Do you think it's okay for us to continue?
Yes, I do think it's okay for you to continue to provide the care that you ordinarily provide. I don't see a time in the immediate future where that's going to be interrupted. I think interruptions may occur if and when there is a surge of patients in hospitals at that time. And I can't tell you that it will or will not be ASCs that will be involved in some of the overflow, but we'll look to lots of different opportunities if we see a surge that can't be met by the current hospital capacity or exceeds the current hospital capacity. But if your question is about the risk for infection, I think that we're not advising stopping any routine procedures this time because of coronavirus risk for infection.
Okay, and my next question, patients have been asking me, should they increase their doses of vitamin C, zinc, things like that they usually take during the flu season? Does that have any effect on this at all?
I'm unaware of any effect that might have. I do know that patients get a degree of comfort. It's more psychological than physiological, but a degree of comfort from increasing doses of medications with unproven effects. But there's no scientific evidence that would be helpful with this particular infection.
Okay, thank you very much. Very appreciated.
To the same question, probably not harmful either.
Okay, good.
Thank you. Yeah.
Moving on to our next question.
Yeah, hi. This is Maria Brown from MDAP. Thank you so much, Dr. Haft, for this marathon session. I wanted to follow up on Dr. Miller and Saba's question regarding children with URIs and how we should be managing kids who present with URIs who either are or not febrile, because we know that in kids being febrile isn't necessarily going to be present. Should pediatricians be telling those families that the child should be isolating at home for 2 weeks, because most likely they're not going to be able to be tested?
Yeah, I, I wish I had a concrete answer based on guidance from either the Department or of Health or from CDC for that very important question. So I know that the pediatricians who are in the Department of Health have been discussing this issue at some great length in the last several days. What I would suggest to for you and for your colleagues is that we work together to see if we can put together, even if it's not a CDC guidance, some general guidance, and perhaps with the something that will give more comfort coming from the department about those specific cases related to pediatrics. Right now, the guidance really is that it devolves to your clinical judgment. But I know that you don't want your clinical judgment to say to every parent for every upper respiratory infection that you need to keep your child at home for 2 weeks, because that would probably become rapidly untenable because of the secondary effects on parents and families. So I think we do owe you and our pediatric colleagues a better answer, and I will make every effort to get an answer to you soon.
Thank you so much. We would greatly appreciate that. We've been getting a lot of questions around that, so we would very much appreciate it. Thank you.
And we'll take our next question.
Welcome. Good evening. My name is David Nyanjo. I'm calling from Columbia, Maryland. We're going to see patients who may initially test negative, but given the length of time it takes to get their results back, and in patients who may have persistent upper respiratory type symptoms, do you advocate retesting, and if so, in what kind of time frame?
No, we're not advocating retesting at all at this time, for several reasons. One is most of the management is clinical management, and second, there's really a short supply of tests. It would even indicate a need for retesting. Most of those might be with hospitalized patients. I hope that's helpful.
Thank you.
And we'll take our next caller.
Yes, this was kind of answered regarding virtual visits. This is more in reference to, as primary care physicians, we're kind of the front line for testing. I do have some older patients that it's a non-respiratory issue, but they do need to see their specialist. They do need to see the cardiologist or the oncologist for follow-up, but are worried about traveling across the bridge because I'm on the Eastern Shore. Is there going to be any way that can streamline which specialist will have access to virtual visits? So now that we all do virtual visits, can I have the patient come into my office and we virtual visit with their specialist?
So, I think the access to telemedicine it crosses all lines. So specialists, oncologists, or cardiologists can also do telemedicine visits. It's not limited to primary care. And it may be, many times I know cardiology, for instance, does remote monitoring. And there's a lot of newer technologies that allow remote monitoring for cardiology. There may be issues, there's many different, wonderful, sophisticated ways that we deliver care. There probably are some telemedicine applications for some, but probably not all of those things. And some of them may just be a challenge that we'll have to meet by doing the best we can with keeping patients isolated to get the specialty care that they need. But the simple answer to your question is that if there's no limitation in terms of telemedicine, that specialists may use that, and it will make those technologies available to all physicians and all providers.
Mm-hmm. And Dr. Hack, if you don't mind, with regards to the aspirin question, I did hear about that, but my understanding it was for specific diseases, not like our basic patients who are cardiac on aspirin. My understanding was they had noted patients who were being treated on aspirin therapy for Hashimoto's, which is more common in Asia than it is in the U.S. They were having rapid onset of COVID for those patients that were exposed and higher degrees of morbidity and mortality. So that I didn't read anything regarding NSAIDs, only aspirin related to certain diseases where high dose aspirin was used to treat the disease process.
Yeah, and I think that very well could be true. And I have to be very clear with this disclaimer that that I'm not presenting myself as an expert in COVID disease, only in representing the department in terms of guidance and to the extent I can providing information that that I have taken from other experts. So what you say, I believe is certainly well within the realm of truth. We've certainly seen other diseases that behave badly in conjunction with aspirin. So thank you for bringing that information. I appreciate it. And thank you for the question.
And we'll take our next question.
Thank you for everything you've been doing. I appreciate it. I was looking at something where it's talking about because the healthcare provider is, you know, particularly vulnerable, you should be, for healthcare personnel, testing may be considered that's been exposed to a patient with suspected without laboratory confirmation because of their often extensive and close contact with vulnerable patients in healthcare settings. Even mild signs and symptoms should be evaluated among potentially exposed healthcare personnel. And, I'm an infectious disease specialist. I mean, I've had two or three patients who, have been, not cleared by the state for testing, but like I was thinking of one particularly who she came in with an unexplained cardiomyopathy. Continued to have rails, and it was not exactly what we thought. And then I actually didn't feel well, and I kind of self-quarantined myself for a while, but we all pulled our head, and we said that you wouldn't test me because I hadn't been exposed to anybody. And so I'm starting to feel better. I went back to the hospital a day and wore my mask, but, I think there's a lot of healthcare personnel who are, we are seeing so many people and, so we're saying, we're going to isolate everybody who really meets the criterion and then everybody else with a flu-like illness we're putting on droplets. But then, and I'm hoping I had the flu because one of my patients, they found out later that she came on the 2nd, and on the 12th we found out she'd had the flu, and of course we were all seeing her without, so hopefully I had the flu. But it would seem like, especially at the hospital, it would be helpful to provide more testing for the healthcare personnel.
Yeah, I think so. What you're describing makes sense. So if you're in a high risk environment and then you develop compatible symptoms, then your provider, whoever that would be, or if it's the hospital employee health program, could very well be take the step to say yes, you should be tested, and that would be under their their clinical judgment in that particular case, and it may make sense. There's no prohibition against that, and clinical judgment actually allows whoever your provider is, their clinical judgment would allow testing for anyone. You could be someone, again, a unique circumstance is what you're describing, and your provider says, well, this is somebody because this is a infectious disease doctor, seeing patients with infectious diseases and now has signs and symptoms, this person should be tested, even though maybe they're not all the perfect continuum of symptoms. Clinical judgment still would prevail in that situation. So it's not prohibited.
So as far as the drive-through testing, then it's really going to be, you have laid out what you want for us. You want more significant people to be tested, but are you saying that we can sign for anybody to go through there that we, in our judgment, thinks needs to go through? Please don't do the mild cases, Dr. Jacobs, but if you're really worried, go ahead and send them. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I think we want you to, use the guidelines. I wouldn't expect that any of our colleagues would.
The guidelines said don't do the mild cases. I mean, I just looked at it again because I think it's very confusing. If it was up to me, I would try to test everybody, because I think that would allow you to know what's actually going on. But you're saying that would overwhelm the system.
It would. That's correct. So that's why your clinical judgment in conjunction with the signs and symptoms and the epidemiology in the area that you're located should guide your clinical judgment. But no one, if you order a test and there's availability of a test, then the test will be done. I think all we're saying, and what the Center for Disease Control is saying, is that maybe not necessary to test everyone, and it may be better to test those individuals who are at higher risk. And I think they're also saying that it may not be necessary to test everyone if it's going to be a mild disease and they're going to be self-quarantined. Will it make a difference how much of a difference will it make whether they're tested or not? And all those things have a whole variety of ramifications, but ultimately it comes down to your clinical judgment.
And the other question is expect
that it's going to be good judgment.
Okay, yeah. And the other question is after somebody's better for 72 hours, are you recommending anything more?
No, there's no further recommendation other than the usual clinical follow-up.
So then people can go back to work and do everything if they're better for 72 hours.
That's correct.
Okay.
Thank you. Once again, that is *1 if you would like to ask a question. Also, if you find your question has been answered, you may remove yourself from the queue by pressing *2. We'll take our next caller.
Hello.
Yes, go ahead.
Hi. I am an endocrinologist in Columbia, Maryland, and one of the questions I had about telemedicine was, we take care of a large Medicare population, diabetics, pregnant patients, what have you, and most of our patients probably would qualify for telemedicine, but one of the things that we won't be able to do in many offices, a lot of patients get labs drawn in our office. So, my best, estimate would be is that unless the labs were absolutely necessary and I have a 75-year-old diabetic and I'm doing telemedicine, I just will have to just clinically judge their blood sugars or what have you over the phone and just skip their A1C and go without the kidney function for now if I have a relatively recent blood test. Would you think that would be adequate?
So I think that's entirely your clinical judgment, and patients could self-monitor blood sugars at home. They can get labs done in a freestanding lab session, but I don't particularly want to usurp anyone's clinical judgment here. That's entirely up to your clinicians, and there's so many unique cases that it would be both inappropriate and impossible to try and usurp your clinical judgment for any of the cases. But in general, the general guidance is, to the extent that you can use telemedicine or telephonic consultations to keep your patients from, who are at risk from being in crowds, et cetera, please do it.
And then one last question. So we have plenty of staff members who are 60 and above. I mean, should we keep them home? I mean, should we let them telework too?
If they're staff members.
Who could be, our billing or office manager or people, who don't need to be present on premises technically, right, if they have the equipment.
Yeah, I think that's encouraged. If you have people particularly who are 60 and over who can do their work remotely, then that's encouraged. It's not, there's no demand to do that, but it's a good practice.
Yeah, I agree. Okay. Thank you so much. This has been very helpful.
Thank you.
And we'll take our next caller.
Hi, Dr. Kwan, an internist in Silver Spring. One quick question is, you said we need a prolonged exposure to a patient to get an infection. What is the prolonged period? Is it 5 minutes, 10 minutes, 20 minutes? If I'm going to try to collect a sample from the patient, is it 5 minutes is safe to do that, or is it not worth the trouble? Thank you.
Thank you for the question. So for collecting nasopharyngeal samples, you or your staff would need to use full personal protective equipment, and that's usually that's protective for prolonged periods of time, not for hours, obviously, but for as long as it would take to obtain a sample. So that's a special case. That is, when you're obtaining a sample, you need to use personal protective equipment. The comment about contact with an individual who is known positive, in order to consider yourself someone who should self-isolate, is the prolonged and close contact. And there's no minutes or put on that contact, because it's very hard to determine exactly minutes that you're in contact with someone. But the closer the contact, and the more prolonged it is, the higher the risk for contagion. So I think it's more a qualitative and quantitative decision. So certainly the quantitative part could be someone who is within 3 feet of an individual, but then if they walk quickly past someone in their 3 feet, it's probably not a significant contact. If they have a 10-minute conversation with someone face-to-face, it probably is. Those are kind of case by case and judgment things. People will tend to err on the side of yes, I think it was close enough and I think it was long enough, but we don't have a specific time limit on it.
Thank you.
I hope that's helpful.
It's been very helpful. Thank you.
Moving on to our next question.
Thank you. My question was answered.
Thank you, Doctor. We'll take our next caller.
Okay. Hello? Can you guys hear me?
Can.
Yes, hi. This is James Hsu. I'm one of the oncologists. So I have a couple of questions here for you. You know, I read from the literature that the hydroxychloroquine actually can be used to treat coronavirus. And even at Hopkins' website, as well as, the government agency in Japan and Korea, they're actually recommending using hydroxychloroquine. Now, does this government, does our country has any kind of studies, trying to use this commonly available drugs to treat this disease?
So I apologize. I'm unaware of the use of hydroxychloroquine for COVID-19. To the best of my knowledge, we're not treating with any agents actively. It doesn't mean that there won't be in the future.
So the other question I want to ask you is that, you know, actually one of the doctors actually has already asked that. Now, in terms of, you know, prolonged exposure, like for if we were to having, you know, if a provider is wearing a mask and also eye shield, would that actually be considered as relatively protective or it is not?
Yes, mask and eye shields are protective against droplets. So that's the standard protection against droplets. And we usually, if we're obtaining a sample, also encourage the use of gloves and a gown at the same time.
Right. So then, if that's the case, then if I were to encounter a patient that actually is unknown of coronavirus, if I preemptively wearing a mask as well as a eye shield as well as a gloves, then I can pretty much assure myself that I probably would not be considered as having an exposure to this disease. Would it be fair to say that?
So it probably would be fair to say that, but it would not. That's not the guidelines. We're not recommending that for routine patient care.
Okay. All right. Thank you so much. That really helps a lot.
All right. We have 10 minutes left and 6 questions left in the queue. So we're going to try to get through them. So please ask your questions quickly so we can let Dr. Half take a break. We're killing him here.
No. Happy to do it, team.
So let's do the last 6 and call it a night. Go ahead, guys.
Thank you.
Hi there. My name is Stephanie Thompson. I'm up in Harford County. I have a quick question about group-related activities. A lot of patients that I see are runners or they're quite active. With a lot of the races that have been scheduled being postponed and pushed back, a lot of the issues that they're having is what do I do now? Can I go to the gym, which holds classes that may be kind of like the Orange Theory type? Is that safe for them to continue to do? And at what point should you give them hints that maybe they should pull back from group activities?
So great question. And I think that what we're saying for the most part that we're eliminating groups of 250 or more. That's by executive order. Smaller groups are less risky in terms of promoting spread of the disease. Individuals should do as much as they can social distancing, that is staying at least 3 feet away from other people. But they can certainly go to the gym or run. They should use surface cleaning. If you go to, particularly if you went to a gym, you should take advantage of the agents that they have for surface cleaning in between pieces of equipment and other things, since high-touch surfaces are ways that the disease is transmitted. But doing things like running or other kinds of activities, even if it's in a group, seem to be relatively low risk. So people should carry on most of their usual activities, but avoid those big crowds. Having said that, my casual observation being out and about today is that for the most part, people are still enjoying close contact with each other. So I don't think we've won that battle. The conscientious people will, and they'll overreact. Those who are not conscientious will be continuing to aggregate.
As a follow-up question, I did notice before we had county tallies in terms of where infections occurred, if they were travel-related versus community-acquired. I've noticed that the websites have now and news reporting has gone to a case count total for Maryland, and it's very hard to find out unless you track down the articles where the most recent cases came from. Will that return? Will we have sort of an interactive map where you can pull it up and see where the newest cases have been diagnosed?
So I know that we've stopped reporting negatives because there's no impendings. So I think that's not an issue. I know that the various counties are reporting cases within the counties. I'll have to check on whether there's going to what happened to the individual county reporting. I think in general what we've pivoted to, rather than counties, for most prior epidemics has been regional reporting. And some of that has to do with small, you know, when you have small numbers, it sometimes there's a confidentiality issue that goes along with that. But I'll be happy. I'll check into that and escalate that question to our team tomorrow.
Okay, greatly appreciated, and thank you so much for spending so much time with us this evening to help, you know, allay our fears here and anxieties.
My pleasure.
Moving on to our next question. Caller, your line is open. Please go ahead. Hearing no response, we'll move on to our next question.
Hello, my name is Brett Levinson. I'm an ophthalmologist. My question to you is, what should we do in our waiting rooms to keep patients separate? Should we spread people apart or keep them on another part of the office and separate them also? Should we do any screening of patients, including taking temperatures for teen patients?
Thank you for the question. And to the extent you can, if it's practical, creating a little space between patients in the waiting room, is a reasonable idea. I'm sorry, I couldn't hear the last part of your question, though.
The last part is, I see mostly routine patients for non-sick. I'm an ophthalmologist. Should we have my staff do screening, like a history in terms of past travel or taking temperature? We don't normally routinely take people's temperature, but should we be checking people's temperature beforehand?
No, I don't think that's necessary. I think if you see patients who are coughing, you want to still put a mask on them, and then you might ask those patients, more questions about their extended medical history and whether they are acutely ill or other kinds of things, and repatriate them back to their primary care, or have them go home and call their primary care doctors. I would say, just as a prudent matter, this is not guidance, but a prudent matter, you have somebody coughing in your office, at this particular time, you probably want to separate them from the others, and it may be, since it's a routine matter, defer that treatment to some other time.
That makes sense. And one last thing. So as part of ophthalmology, we are very close to our patients at our slit lamp in front of their faces. Should we as doctors have masks? Yes, many times. But I'm so close to my patients in terms of their faces to examine their eyes. I'm wearing gloves now. But is there any advantage to a mask in the brief encounter that will have to be a minute?
So still, the answer for that still is the same. We're not recommending masks for staff unless they're taking samples. I fully understand and very clearly understand what you're saying, that you are very close to your patients face to face when in your routine work. So even though it may not be a standard recommendation, I would say do what you think in good conscience.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
And we'll take our next caller.
Yes, hi, sorry. Was wondering if you can give us some practical solutions on what we do when one has to self-isolate. What does that mean in terms of the patient? Do they just stay in their room and they get brought meals and open the door quickly and give it to them? Or just keep your 3 feet distance or something like that?
Yeah, exactly. It's the staying in their home and keeping socially isolated 3 feet away from other individuals in the home, not sharing hygienic equipment, using a separate bathroom, to the extent possible, separating them from others who could be at risk. But predominantly, it's staying at home.
Okay, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
And we'll take our final question.
Hi, this is Dr. Nathan, Aruna Nathan. My question is regarding specimen collection in the office. I still have some difficulty understanding the well-ventilated room for collection specimen if we have to do it in our offices. And I'll take my question. I'll just come off, put it on mute now.
Okay. Thank you for the question. And thank you for hanging in and holding your question for this length of time. So for both of those things. And the guidance recently has changed, and it's simply an exam room with a closed door. So it should be, if you have a best ventilated room, that would be better, but the limitation is just an exam room with a closed door.
So can I ask a follow-up to that?
Sure.
If we do test someone in the closed door, and then if they do test positive, and then and so they have had contact with me and one other staff, even though we've taken all precautions, do we then have, so they will be in the office maybe for about 20 minutes to or so at the most. Will that have implications on other patients moving, coming into that room, or we should designate only one room, as you said earlier, for that sick room and only use it for that purpose, for specimen collection?
Yes, it's always best to do that. And if you do the appropriate surface cleaning afterwards, you can put somebody else in the room subsequently. But as long as you have the PPE, you use the appropriate PPE, even if the patient's positive, you don't need to self-isolate. We'll assume that you were protected.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for the clarification.
Thank you, everyone, for the patience and staying in the queue. I know how challenging it is to stay in the queue for that length of time.
So in closing, I want to thank everybody. Dr. Bruno, did you want to say anything at all in closing?
Yeah, this has been really informative. I really appreciate Dr. Haff staying on so late and all the amazing questions. I think we got a lot better direction. A lot of people feel a lot more comfortable now that we've been able to get all these questions answered. And, you know, a lot could change between now and Monday, but I think that we're all breathing a little bit of a sigh of relief knowing that we have a great effort by our state health department, and really appreciate your time explaining this.
Thank you, Dr. Bruce.
And this is Gene again. Just in closing, we will be getting information out through the website, and we will work on additional calls with the health department and Dr. Haff for physicians as we move forward. Again, thank you, Dr. Haff. Is there anything else you'd like to say in closing?
Yep, let's thank everyone for being online. There were excellent questions. Thank my colleagues across the state for the great work that they have always done. And I know that they will continue to do through these very challenging times. It's good to know that we have such great providers and physicians in Maryland. And we will, as Gene Ransom said, we'll continue to provide information and updates through the website and anticipate daily calls or webinars as things change. And we'll post that information through MedCai and on the department's website. Thank you all.
And that concludes tonight's call. Thank you, everyone.
Dr. Haff, did you want to make a plug for the volunteering for the medical corps as well? Were you able to mention that?
Oh, no. Thank you very much. Good point. So there, for those who are interested, we have had for many, many years a Maryland Medical Reserve Corps. That's something that you can volunteer for. There's training that goes along with it. It is used during crises of a variety of kinds, both statewide and nationally. And I will put that information for the Maryland Reserve Corps on the website also. In fact, Gene will provide it to Gene so he can also post that in the MedCai communications.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you all very much. Thank you.
And that does conclude today's conference. We thank you for your participation. Have a wonderful day.